From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A nationwide ceasefire in Syria is more likely than before following recent meetings by the international community in Vienna that, according to the UN envoy for the country, Stefan de Mistura, speaking after an informal briefing he gave to UN member states on the two recent conferences in the Austrian capital. The meetings brought together foreign ministers and representatives from several nations, regional groups, and the UN, as Deanne Penn reports.
Mr. de Mistura reminded reporters of what he called the deliverables from the two rounds of talks. For Vienna 1, it was a future roadmap for a political process in Syria, while Vienna 2 concerned a nationwide ceasefire in parallel with a political dialogue that would take place in Geneva, Switzerland. He was asked about the prospects for the ceasefire.
We're talking about a large ceasefire. Now, why is this now more likely? I'm not saying guaranteed, but more likely than before. Well, first of all, because there are indications that those countries who are inside the Vienna meeting room, and look at them, who they are, and those who are therefore involved or have the capacity of influencing those who are fighting, have a interest in seeing a ceasefire taking place.
Mr. de Mistura added that territory under the control of the terrorist group ISIL or Daesh would naturally not be part of any potential ceasefire. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
However, on Thursday, it appeared there were still conflicts that had not yet been resolved over how to proceed.
Bottom line is, I do not foresee a situation in which we can end the civil war in Syria while Assad remains in power.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama Thursday, as he insisted yet again that the crisis in Syria will not be resolved as long as the country's president, Bashar al-Assad, remains in power.
And by the way, that's not a matter of my decision making. Even if I said that was okay, I still don't think it would actually work. You could not get the Syrian people, the majority of them, to agree to that kind of outcome.
Obama said that the U.S. and its allies believe that the so-called Islamic State cannot be eradicated until there's a political transition in Syria. But others say the U.S. is putting the cart before the horse, with President Assad himself saying that the internationally agreed upon timeline for political transition in that country may only begin after the Islamic State and other terror groups are defeated in the country. That position was echoed by Russia and Iran. Moscow has repeatedly warned that calls on Assad to step down will only undermine efforts to end the conflict and take out the so-called Islamic State. Meanwhile, a number of U.S. allies are now calling for the formation of a united front of all anti-Islamic State forces in a war against the terrorist group following last week's Paris attacks. In Europe, anti-immigration sentiment has increased since last week's Paris attacks, with anti-immigrant rallies being held even in some areas where refugees were previously welcomed. RT's Anastasia Cherkina was at one such rally in Munich.
We are in Munich, the Bavarian city, which just months ago welcomed refugees with open arms and rounds of applause. Following the Paris attacks, moods have shifted, changing the debate over access to Europe as well as open borders inside it. Let's find out what people have to say.
It's possible that there are terrorists among the refugees who have arrived in the last few months.
They could be hiding in the crowds that are entering Germany and other countries and meeting with their contacts when they arrive to plan terrorist attacks.
It's just a matter of time before they show their true face. When extremist groups need them, they will be called to action. You never know when.
The best thing would be just to stop people coming all together.
Anastasia Cherkina, RT, Munich, Germany.
And here in the U.S., the House of Representatives voted on a bill requiring security screening for Syrian and Iraqi refugees that would effectively block President Obama's plan to accept 30,000 refugees from Syria next year. That action followed actions in 31 states to put a halt to the resettlement of refugees citing concerns of potential terrorism. This was Florida Governor Rick Scott.
We love immigration. We have so many agreements in our state, so many languages spoken, but we don't want one terrorist in our state. Right. I mean, slow down.
Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders condemned those actions.
Hundreds of thousands of people have lost everything, have nothing left but the shirts on their backs. We will not turn our backs on the refugees from Syria and Afghanistan.
Europe remained on high alert Friday for signs of terrorist activity. Sweden raised its threat level to the highest ever just a day after an international football match in Germany was canceled an hour before kickoff. CCTV's Guy Henderson reported from Berlin.
Swedish police have launched a manhunt of their own. Extra officers have been deployed on the unusually quiet streets of the capital, Stockholm.
I'm not scared, but I think about it and I'm a bit nervous. But at the same time, I feel that the best thing is not to care about it.
One feels a bit worried because it can happen. It happened in France. It can happen here.
German police remain on high alert too. On Tuesday night, SWAT teams stormed a stadium in Hanover an hour before an international football match was due to kick off. A tip from French intelligence had warned of a serious threat. And officials say the now dead ringleader of the Paris attacks, Abdelhamid Aboud, spent time in Germany. In Berlin on Thursday, the Austrian and German chancellors acknowledged a continent-wide threat.
Our approach is to hold together in Europe. The freedom-loving countries of this world have to stand together to find the perpetrators, but also to defend and secure our way of life.
We are so vulnerable on all levels, investigation, police, but also political answers. We have to stand together. We cannot back off. We have to get closer and act united.
But nerves are frayed. In Bulgaria, special forces boarded a diverted Polish passenger plane, a bomb scare that turned out to be a hoax. The alerts in both Germany and Sweden appear to have been more than a precaution. Germany's Bild Zeitung newspaper says it's seen documents that show the threat to Hanover was very real and involved a plan to detonate multiple explosives simultaneously. We may never know how close that came. But still, there's little sense of panic. Europe, it seems, is determined to carry on. Guy Henderson, CCTV, Berlin.
And the anxiety over terrorist threats continued as reports of a hostage taking in Mali involving two gunmen, 140 guests, and 30 employees at the Radisson Hotel in Bamako came in. Malian special forces were deployed, and the country's state broadcaster said U.S. AFRICOM Special Operations Forces had intervened in the rescue. A report late Friday at the New York Times website said, however, that, according to what it characterized as a senior American defense official who was speaking on condition of anonymity, the U.S. military played no direct role in helping clear the hotel or rescue hostages, and there was only one American service member on the scene. According to numerous press reports, as of late Friday, 27 people were reportedly killed. Reports said that an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group had claimed responsibility. The recent terrorist attacks in Paris, Beirut, and on Egypt's Sinai Peninsula reinforced the fact that extremism and terrorism are not constrained by borders. That, according to Nikolai Mladenov, the UN Secretary General's Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, he spoke with the Security Council via teleconference from Jerusalem and said that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict cannot be separated from the global threat of terrorism.
On behalf of the UN family here in Jerusalem, I would like to extend my deepest condolences and sympathies to the families of the victims of the abhorrent terrorist attacks in Paris, Beirut, and the Sinai. These tragic events serve to reinforce the reality that the extremism and terrorism that has infected many parts of the Middle East is no longer constrained by barriers. It can strike anywhere, anytime, and poses a grave threat to international peace and security. Against this backdrop, we cannot separate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from this global threat. Establishing a Palestinian state while addressing Israel's substantial security concerns would yield major dividends not only for Israelis and Palestinians alike, but for the entire region. We owe it to the people of this troubled land who, despite endless setbacks and disappointments, have continued to maintain hope that negotiated peace can be realized. I can assure you that the Secretary General remains steadfast in his support of any effort to restore the hope that a two-state solution can be achieved through negotiations. But the long road ahead requires leadership. Leadership that has been glaringly absent to date, Mr. President. Thank you for your attention.
In this week's news from Latin America and the Caribbean, elections in Haiti, Paraguay, Argentina, and Venezuela, Cuban migrants in Costa Rica, and more. For an update, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
I was very glad to see that in an earlier message you said that you'd been covering the Haitian, the sequel to the Haitian elections, because, and it seems to me that, and what's happened has been a repeat of the of earlier elections in which, on a very low turnout, very important public officials were elected. In this case, the presidential vote, and I think also a legislative, the repeat of the legislative elections as well. But and something that's that is very disturbing is the way that, according to the report in Haiti Liberté, the Haiti Liberté website reported that over 70% of people abstained, so that the eventual winner of the person who gets elected as Haiti's next president will have probably under 10% of the vote.
Right, I know.
Which is, you know, what kind of democracy is that?
That's the kind America exports.
So, you know, and that's an extreme. Hi, Don, you okay? Mm. Hi, Don.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, sorry, are you all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Yeah, and it's just extremely disturbing, isn't it? That a country that's trying to rebuild itself after an extremely disturbing couple of decades of political events is still at a stage where its electoral processes are completely without credibility.
Yeah, that is.
And you know, that can only lead to further instability, which can't be good for the welfare of the people of Haiti. And this is all happening under the eyes and under the control of the United States, of Canada and France in particular.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, and it's as though they're consolidating what is an extremely disturbing precedent for the region.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, that's something that, you know, on the other hand, last weekend we had elections, municipal elections in Paraguay that were very encouraging from the point of view of people who are anxious to see progressive forces take power in Latin America and the Caribbean, so as to advance the process of regional integration and consolidating the processes of improving access to basic rights like good healthcare, good education. And those are the things that the progressive governments in the region stand for. And increasingly, they stand for economic stability against the ridiculous austerity programs and the kind of Washington consensus, the inheritance of the Washington consensus that tends to be imposed by the international financial institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and their regional auxiliary organizations, like the Inter-American Development Bank, for example.
Right.
But anyway, that election result in Paraguay was very encouraging, especially in the run-up to the election in Argentina. That in Paraguay, what happened was that in Asunción, an electoral alliance called Juntos Podemos, which is an unhappy echo of the campaign of Barack Obama, but in this case, at least it does seem to have led to a progressive result. Juntos Podemos means together we can.
Right.
And the candidate who won there in the capital of Paraguay was a guy called Mario Ferreiro, who unexpectedly defeated the official candidate, the ruling party candidate, and that's a very good precedent for the forthcoming election this weekend on Sunday in Argentina.
Mm.
And perhaps we should talk about that.
For sure.
So, yeah, and the election on the Sunday in Argentina is a presidential runoff between the two candidates that came first and second in the first round of the presidential elections on whenever it was, I think it was October the 25th. And those two candidates represent very, very clear political options, very, very different to the situation in the United States, where it's difficult to tell the difference between the candidate of the Republican Party and the candidate of the Democrat Party.
Right.
Certainly in terms of foreign policy, but in Argentina, there's a very, very clear difference between the candidate for the progressive Frente para la Victoria political coalition, which is the coalition currently in government under President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and the candidate for that political movement is Daniel Scioli, and he's over the last, since the result on October the 25th, he's come out into his own, some because he was previously regarded as very much under the shadow of Cristina Fernandez and the legacy of Cristina Fernandez and her deceased husband, the much-lamented Néstor Kirchner. And Daniel Scioli, over the last couple of weeks, has very much blossomed as his own candidate, with his own image and his own policy that he's projecting, that are very much they're very much a continuation of the policies that the previous governments under Néstor Kirchner and Cristina Fernandez that they implemented, but also they recognize the what still has to be done in terms of consolidating a program that meets the needs, the material and moral needs, focusing on the needs of the human person, of the people of Argentina. By contrast, the policies of Mauricio Macri, the right-wing candidate, a candidate historically very much identified with the worst, most reactionary elements of the Argentinian ruling classes.
Mm.
And his policies are openly, if you read them and look at the things that he's saying, it's absolutely clear that he's going to take Argentina back to where it was at the in the early 1990s, totally committed to the policies that have now been failing for 20 years, but he's determined to take Argentina back there. And it's so ironic that his political movement calls itself Cambiemos, Let's Change. And but what they're saying is, let's change backwards.
Yeah.
The
period before Kirchner's took over and fixed things is actually referred to as the lost decade, and the policies he wants to go back to more or less echo that.
Well, certainly the 1980s was throughout Latin America was a lost decade, and in Argentina there was a kind of bogus, there was kind of fake boom, very similar to the kind of fake boom that was stoked in the United States in the first 5 or 6 years of this century,
right,
between the end of the 2001 recession and the Great Recession of 2008. And there was this fake, wasn't there? There was this fake prosperity that was based on a massive credit bubble.
Right.
And that something very similar happened in Argentina through the 90s. And that all collapsed in the wake of the Russian default and the Brazilian, the problems with Brazil in the last few years of the 1990s. And in the wake of those international financial crises, Argentina entered a crisis because the policies of the 1990s, the neoliberal policies that have been followed, simply weren't sustainable. And what Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Fernandez have done is rebuild Nicaragua from the ashes.
Argentina.
Very much from the ashes.
Right, Argentina.
Argentina's economy was completely collapsed. And one of the key things that Nestor Kirchner did, and Cristina after him, was to renegotiate and restructure Argentina's foreign debt. And that has been one of the areas of attack by the United States corporate financial elites.
Right.
Because they've tried to undermine the restructuring, the debt restructuring, that Argentina agreed with over 90% of its creditors.
Right.
And Mauricio Macri has said that he will work with these corporate financial vultures, the so-called vulture funds, to put a solution to the conflict between Argentina as a sovereign country and this tiny group of ruthless financial gangsters who are trying to hold Argentina to ransom for something over $1.5 billion.
Right. Yeah, which is sort of like making a deal with the guy that does kneecaps down the street on usurious loans. And these people bought this debt, the ones that are trying to claim it, for like 2 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, but that's only one element of Mauricio Macri's program. He's going to implement public sector spending cuts, very much in line with the ridiculous austerity program that has failed in Europe.
Right.
And it's completely failed in Europe. It's failed everywhere it's been put into place. And you can see the effects with the increasing poverty and increasing inequality in the United States as well. And that's the program that Mauricio Macri intends and publicly says he's going to implement in Argentina. But he dresses it up with a discourse or a sales pitch, if you like, that he is going to lift Argentina into a new era of economic prosperity. But he knows very well that he's talking about economic prosperity for the Argentinian elites and a return to stagnation and lower living standards for Argentina's majority.
Right. Helpful.
So, apart from the internal issues that Argentina's voters are going to decide on Sunday, the election is also very, very important in regional terms because Argentina has been such a key player in the development of regional integration institutions like UNASUR.
Right.
Nestor Kirchner was absolutely key figure, along with Ignacio Lula da Silva and Hugo Chavez, the former Venezuelan president, in establishing UNASUR. And you can see now how there are different incidents happening increasingly in an attempt to chip away at this architecture of regional integration that has been so painstakingly established over the last 10 years or so. For example, you've got Chile trying to intervene in the Venezuelan electoral process,
mm-hmm.
and it's the Chilean Supreme Court has instructed the government, as if the judicial structure can actually do that anywhere, to intervene and criticize the Venezuelan government for the imprisonment of Leopoldo López, the Venezuelan opposition leader, who was guilty of inciting violence and trying to promote the conditions that would provoke a civil war in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that sovereign decision by Venezuela's judicial system, you now find the Chilean authorities trying to attempt to intervene in Venezuela's internal affairs.
Right.
And that's absolutely No, it's just unprecedented, you know,
yeah.
And that's, and another, here in Nicaragua over the last couple of weeks, we've had another example of that in the way the Costa Rican government, personally, much to my surprise and much to my disappointment, because I believe that the new government following the period of Costa Rica's government presidency under Laura Chinchilla was going to be much more positive in its relations with Nicaragua. But in fact, it looks as though the bureaucracy that's installed in Costa Rica has created a kind of inertia that means that there's a kind of continuity in Costa Rica's very counterproductive policy in the region, in particular towards Nicaragua, but not just towards Nicaragua. And what's happened is that in the days running up to November the 15th, the Costa Rican authorities gave temporary travel documents specifically to a group of well over 1,000 Cuban migrants. And they encouraged these Cuban migrants to enter Nicaragua illegally without passing through the immigration and customs, the established immigration and customs posts. And the Nicaraguan police and army found themselves having to cope with these groups of Cuban migrants entering Nicaragua illegally, and then having to kind of send them back to Costa Rica. And then on Sunday the 15th, there was an extraordinary incident at the Nicaragua's frontier post with Costa Rica on the southern frontier, called Peñas Blancas, where over 1,000 Cuban migrants attempted to enter Nicaragua without... They just wanted to walk through. And there was a very, very... This was a very serious incident because the Costa Rican authorities allowed the Cubans to try and enter Nicaragua by force. No, without satisfying the normal... immigration procedures in any way, and that it was just absolutely extraordinary. And the attitude of the Costa Ricans try and defend. Imagine what would happen if the Mexican authorities or the Canadian authorities deliberately issued travel documents, temporary travel documents, to a group of migrants, so say over 1,000 migrants up at some frontier post, either on the Canadian or Mexican border, and encourage them, say, go on, off you go, there's the United States, away you go.
Yeah, say like 1,000 Syrian migrants, for example.
Yeah, imagine what would happen. And just absolutely unprecedented and extraordinary. And the Costa Rican government is trying to defend itself by saying, oh, well, we're trying to facilitate the passage of these Cubans to the United States, which is where they want to go. And, you know, and in the United States, the United States will welcome them with open arms because they're Cuban migrants. And the Nicaraguan response has been extremely firm. While trying to treat the Cuban migrants in a humanitarian way, they're insisting that the Costa Rican government meet Costa Rica's obligations to these people. And what's so suspicious is that it's very much a concentrated group of Cuban migrants. It's not a mixture of migrants from, say, Ecuador, Peru, Colombia, and other countries. It's specifically a group of Cuban migrants who seem to be taking part in some kind of organized trafficking of migrants that the Costa Rican government is now facilitating.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.